Chapter 69. Czech Rapacity. There had never been a country called Czechoslovakia. Europe had known for a thousand years a land called Bohemia, which was steeped in German culture and which had been a province of the Holy Roman Empire. Its Gothic art rivaled the Rhineland cathedrals. The Habsburgs were kings of Bohemia, and in 1914 Bohemia, along with its neighbors Sudetenland, Slovakia, and Ruthenia, was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Those who then dreamed of an independent Bohemia or Slovakia could be counted on one hand. One of them was a lackluster professor who appeared most respectful of the imperial order. His name was Thomas Masaryk. But he was more than just a professor at the University of Vienna. Well before the Sarajevo assassination, he was the head of a secret Pan-Slavic organization controlled from St. Petersburg. He was, in secret, what Pašek was in Serbia. He had been warned in time that war was approaching and left for the safety of Paris. Masaryk lived in France for 3 years on money paid by the Russian embassy in Paris, while his counterpart Edward Beneš was supported by the British. After the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, the United States would pick up the cost of maintaining the two Pan-Slavic agents. Masaryk was also a high-ranking Freemason and was involved with the Grand Orient Lodge, which had controlled France since its revolution of 1789. Likewise, Beneš was very much involved in the secrets of British masonry. As a Pan-Slav agent working for Russian expansionists, Masaryk was thinking in 1914 of establishing several Russianized Grand Duchies, which would supplant the Austrian and German regimes in Central Europe. He would present this plan to the capitals of Western Europe. On April 15, 1915, he made it public in the form of a memorandum to the British Foreign Office: Bohemia and Moravia will form a kingdom placed under the sovereignty of a Russian Grand Duke. The Tsar apparently agreed with the plan, since he had already made known to the Poles his intention of establishing their national unity, as President Poincaré pointed out in his book Invasion. Masaryk did not realize that his admiring disciple and fellow Grand Master, Beneš, was plotting against him in the best Masonic tradition, secretly. During the summer of 1918, Beneš engineered Masaryk's being named president of a yet-to-be-created Czechoslovakian Republic. The move was supposed to honor a great man, but was really meant to neutralize Masaryk. From that time on, Beneš pulled the strings, hiding behind Masaryk's ceremonial title. The Paris Grand Orient, which had total control of the French government, backed Beneš as the best of the two Masons to implement its policy. Masaryk was directed to cultivate a close relationship with President Wilson. He used his excellent memory to learn entire chapters of some mediocre books Wilson had written. He then recited them to an amazed Wilson, claiming he had never read anything so profound in all his life. No one had yet appreciated his genius to such an extent, and Wilson reciprocated by regarding Masaryk as a genius. Wilson became all ears to the shameless flatteries of Masaryk, and it was not long before he was in favor of the creation of a Czechoslovakian Republic. Masaryk easily convinced Wilson that it was his duty to bring freedom to the Czechs and the Slovaks, because America was the torchbearer of liberty. He also waxed heavily rhetorical on the Calvinistic values that united the Czechs and the Americans. Wilson loved all he heard and decided to back Masaryk's noble crusade for freedom, even though he confused the Slovakians with the Slovenians. Beneš and Masaryk kept talking about the Slovaks, and it became accepted they were one and the same people as the Czechs. Nothing could have been further from the truth. Slovakia was a proud and distinct country, having nothing in common with the likes of Masaryk and Beneš. At no time did the Slovaks deputize the Czechs, Masaryk or Beneš, to represent them in any capacity. Masaryk's call to Wilson to liberate the Slovaks was nothing but the first step in colonizing 31 to 32 million Slovaks against their will. In order to deceive the gullible Wilson still more, Masaryk organized on May 27, 1915 a Treaty of Cohabitation between Czechs and Slovaks. The treaty was signed in Cleveland by a few men of Slovak origin who were now naturalized Americans. It was meant to impress Wilson with the Slovaks' aspirations to join themselves to the Czechs' freedom movement. Masaryk himself related how this particular operation was set up. The treaty was really a private agreement among a few emigrants. In fact, all were emigrants, except two, who had been naturalized for some time. This was only a piece of paper without value or much practical importance. It was even signed on a holiday, which, according to American law, made it null and void. Masaryk, the making of a state. Yet this bit of null and void paper would trigger the absorption of 3.1 million Slovaks into a regime they never wanted to be part of. Beneš organized phony committees of Czechs and Slovaks along the Cleveland lines in London, Amsterdam, Geneva, and Paris. These committees would in June 1918 name Masaryk as President of the Republic of Czechoslovakia, which of course did not exist geographically or legally at that time. All these activities were based on the Cleveland Treaty. By July 30, 1918, Masaryk was again using the Cleveland Treaty. On July 19, 1918, I countersigned the Cleveland Agreement of May 27, 1915 between the delegates of Slovak and Czech Emigrant Societies of America. The accord had been set up in order to satisfy the aspirations of a small group of Slovaks who dreamed of God knows what childishness, an autonomous Slovakia with its own administration, its own parliament, its own courts, its own schools. Without hesitation, I approved in the name of the Czech nation the engagements taken in the name of the Slovaks. Masaryk, the making of a state. Thus Masaryk had approved without hesitation the arrangements he himself called childish. Thus a few misguided Slovak dreamers had been duped into signing a worthless piece of paper, thinking they were striking a blow for their freedom. An ignorant and naive Wilson had endorsed the farcical treaty officially recognizing the state of Czechoslovakia, concocted in Cleveland and Pittsburgh. The men who had assumed the right to shape the destiny of the Czechs and the Slovaks had left their homelands a long time ago and had lost touch with the realities facing their former compatriots. With an exception or two, they were no longer Czechs or Slovaks, but naturalized emigrants. Their bizarre scheme had been sold to Wilson and the Allies with deceit and without any provisions for the people they claimed to represent to express their opinion. No one would ask any of the 3.5 million Slovaks of Slovakia what they thought, or even less, whether they wanted to be subjugated to a nebulous entity called Czechoslovakia. Without consultation, they would be thrown in the Czech bag like so many pounds of potatoes. Wilson had been so enchanted with the wily Masaryk that he had totally forgotten the self-determination clauses of his 14 points. Not only were the Slovaks not asked their opinions, but they were systematically prevented from saying a single word on their own behalf. The Masonic government of France hated them with a passion because they were traditional Catholics. The French politicians of Masonic discipline had a vigorous anti-Catholic policy at home and abroad, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire was high on their list for destruction. In this endeavor, they had the full backing of the British establishment. When the Slovaks attempted to let their views be known in Paris, the French police ruthlessly suppressed them. The shocking treatment meted out to these unfortunate people was recorded by the American delegate to the peace conference, Colonel Bonsai, in his book Suitors and Suppliants. The hero, or rather the victim, was the Slovak nationalist leader Monsignor Hlinka. It was traditional for a priest to lead this deeply Catholic country. The last Slovak leader would be Monsignor Tiso, who was summarily hanged by the Czech communists in 1945, while he prayed and clasped his rosary. Monsignor Hlinka realized at the end of 1918 that his people were being railroaded into servitude. He decided to enlighten the Paris conference as to the real aspirations of his fellow Slovaks. First, he was refused an exit visa by the Czech police under orders from Beneš. He left clandestinely for Warsaw, where the French embassy did everything to stop him from reaching Paris. Finally, the papal nuncio in Poland, the future Pope Pius XI, helped Hlinka and his companions escape the hostile environment created by the powerful French embassy. They had to make their way like fugitives through Croatia, Italy, and Switzerland in appalling conditions before entering France, again clandestinely. They had had no shelter, food, or sleep for days. In Paris they found refuge in a monastery so that Hlinka was at last able to notify the American delegation of his presence. Colonel Bonsall went to meet with Hlinka. "I keep," wrote Bonsall, "excellent memories of my relations with this Slovakian priest. I often think he was the most sympathetic man among the numerous delegates I had to deal with. He had the dark and luminous eyes of great beauty, which in truth were the windows of his soul and an obvious sincerity." Father Hlinka received Bonsall in his little cell. He produced a letter from General Stefanik, who had fought in the French army before being assassinated by Beneš agents as he was returning to Slovakia. He had entrusted Father Hlinka with a letter to the American delegation: "I hope to join Father Hlinka and his friends soon. Please try to facilitate an interview with the President or Colonel House. I can guarantee the absolute veracity of what they will have to say." It had taken almost 3 months for Father Hlinka and his friends to reach Paris, and Bonsall intimated they had arrived almost too late. "I feared that," answered the priest, "but our delay is only due to the extraordinary measures taken by the Czechs to stop us from reaching Paris." Father Hlinka explained the Slovaks were fearful of the communists. The Czechs had told them that only unity between Czechs and Slovaks would provide salvation from the communists. Why not try to join forces? In any case, it would only be a temporary measure, like a trial marriage. If the union proved inadequate, we both would go our own way. But within 3 weeks the mask dropped. We suffered more in this short period of time at the hands of the Czechs than in 1,000 years of our history. Remember my words. Time will show they are true. Bonsall reminded Father Hlinka that the Pittsburgh Declaration had guaranteed Slovak autonomy, to which he replied that the same declaration had also guaranteed Slovak representation at the peace conference. "We have endured everything," continued the priest, "from the Czech soldiery and the Prague politicians. The Czechs consider Slovakia as a colony and treat us as if we were savages from Africa. To the foreigners they claim we belong to the same race, but as soon as they get the chance they treat us like serfs." Bonsall reported what he learned to Wilson, who was amazed to hear that there was a difference of opinion between Czechs and Slovaks. Realizing he had been duped, he angrily interrupted Beneš's annexationist speech at the conference on May 5, 1919, "Under no circumstances, I declare this formally, have I ever stated that I deemed a popular consultation in Slovakia as superfluous." Conference Transcript Folio 9, Series XXI, Dossier G/L. Beneš knew what to expect if a referendum were ever to be held in Slovakia and proceeded to remove the originator of such dangerous ideas. He asked Tardieu to take immediate action. Tardieu was glad to oblige his co-conspirator. The next night the French police broke into the monastery and dragged out Father Hlinka and his associates. They were spirited out of France the same night. When Bonsall returned to consult with the Slovakian delegation, all he found were empty cells. The abbot of the monastery tearfully explained to Bonsall, "Beneš and Tardieu, Tardieu and Beneš, they are the guilty ones." The American delegation officially protested to Tardieu, who replied that the Slovaks were strange Russians of the Carpathians who were difficult to understand as well as to assimilate. "It would be absurd to convert this part of Europe into a whirlwind of governments, a headache of little nations." The American delegation was stupefied at such insolence, and Tardieu was warned that he was not taking the right path for the establishment of a solid Czechoslovakian state. After his manhandling at the hands of the French police, Father Hlinka made his way back to Slovakia, where he continued his fight in defense of his people. They wanted to elect him to the parliament the Czechs had imposed on them. Hlinka, wrote Bonsall, decided to accept his election in order to fight for the freedom of his people. A few weeks before the election, Czech police burst into Hlinka's house in the middle of the night and took him to jail, far away from the peasants who honored him. For months he was treated with such cruelty that his health was permanently impaired. Poor Father Hlinka deserved better than this crown of thorns. Suitors and Suppliants, page 271. In fact, Father Hlinka had been savagely and repeatedly beaten in jail, where he was held without the slightest due process of law. Thus ended the Slovak attempt to exercise their right of self-determination. The Slovaks were not the only people to be the object of Czech greed. There were also 691,923 Hungarians and 640,000 Ruthenians who, like the Slovaks, had been immediately muzzled. Above all, there were 3,231,688 Germans living in the Sudetenland. Altogether, these diverse peoples would be railroaded into servitude through the good offices of the Versailles Treaty. The Czechs represented half of the Czechoslovakian population according to statistics provided by Beneš. According to other statistics, they were well in the minority. The creation of this sausage-shaped state 700 miles long was due to the relentless schemes of European Freemasons. For a long time, they had attempted to destroy the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the last Catholic bastion in Europe. The Masons had, a little more than a century before, unleashed a bloody revolution in France, which had given them control of that country ever since. They were now ready to take control of Austria-Hungary. The Sudeten Germans were a very dynamic element of the Catholic Empire, and it was very important for the Masons to separate them forever from Austria. The public is often misled by the innocuous aspects of Masonry, whether sartorial or ceremonial. That middle-aged men like to feel important by reciting secret oaths and bedecking their chests with triangles, compasses, squares, or mini aprons is not very disturbing. It is just their way of playing at voodoo or overcoming their lack of individuality in a kind of group therapy. However, in 1914 the rituals of Freemasonry meant something more. It was consumed by an insatiable greed for power. From 1914 to 1918, Freemasons occupied most positions of power in the various European states, including the armed forces. In France, from General Sarrail to Poincaré and Tardieu, almost all the ministers were fanatical Masons. Masons were equally prominent in Great Britain and the United States at all levels of government, business, and the media. Against this formidable array of power, Catholic Austria stood alone. The first Austrians would soon fall under the blows of concerted Masonic attack. With the destruction of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in November 1918, the Sudeten Germans made known their intention to declare their independence and create their own state, which they did almost immediately. How these decisions were of any concern to the Czechs is hard to fathom. The Sudeten Germans were of a different ethnicity, different language, customs, and religion. They had been separated from Austria, but no one had mandated the Czechs to replace Austria. Nevertheless, Czech soldiers poured into the Sudetenland to overthrow the Sudeten government. Sudeten ministers were thrown in jail and beaten up, just like the Slovakian patriots, and many villagers were shot to death. Again, the protests of the persecuted Sudeten Germans were silenced by the Masonic conspiracy of Beneš, Tardieu, Poincaré, and their allies. Now there was nothing to stop Beneš from spreading Masonic rule over more Catholic populations, including 3.5 million Slovaks, 1.5 million Hungarians, and 75,000 Poles. Beneš had a plan for a greater Czechoslovakia to stretch from the Danube to the River Spree, that is, from the outer Berlin suburbs to the center of Budapest. The plan had been drafted in 1916 in the secrecy of Grand Orient Masonic lodges. Flushed with the success of his aggression, Beneš was now unveiling it for all to see. Under the heading "Destroy Austria-Hungary," a detailed map had been drawn by a cartographer called Kufner at Beneš's direction. The new Czechoslovakia would swallow the Austrian Empire and more. The borders stretched from Budapest to Dresden and southeast Berlin. Silesia was also to be annexed. The plan and map was later published by the Delagrave Publishing Company in Paris. Caught between communism and Freemasonry, the people of Central Europe did not have a chance. The Grand Orient shared the same anti-clericalism as the communists. They had always worked together against Christians and regarded the destruction of the Austro-Hungarian Empire as a mutual achievement. The power of international Masonry was such that Wilson did not dare go beyond mild verbal protestations at the flagrant enslavement of 10 million people by the Czech Masonic establishment. There was never any question of invoking his 14 points on their behalf. For appearance's sake, Benes had promised in 1919 that the peoples who had been delivered to his rule would enjoy a large degree of autonomy. This was pure hypocrisy from a tyrant wearing the mask of a liberal statesman. In the 20 years that followed, the Prague Masons stripped their conquered populations of all freedom, dignity, and national character. The Czech language was imposed everywhere, the schools, the courts, all the army were Czech and controlled by Czech Masons. Those who resisted were tortured, jailed, or killed. For 20 years these peoples would be forced to endure their Masonic master's oppression. Deliverance would come in 1938 and the Masonic bane over Central Europe would be broken. The Masonic defeat in 1938 and 1939 would precipitate World War II. International Masonry declared war on the country which had freed the oppressed. Secretary of State Lansing had correctly predicted, the Versailles peace treaties will be the source of a new war, it is as sure as the return of day after night. The Second World War would therefore not be a sudden and spontaneous event, but a direct and inevitable consequence of the ill-inspired treaties of Versailles. The war had been declared at Versailles itself on June 28, 1919. It can be argued that the Communists behaved much worse in 1945 than the Allies in 1918. But the results in terms of suffering were not very different. Furthermore, the 1919 peacemakers, unlike Stalin, had cloaked themselves with liberal and humanitarian respectability. Communist barbarism was unspeakable, but it corresponded to a predictable pattern established in 1917. The Communists had killed and killed, they had promised nothing except more terror. The Allies, on the other hand, were all respectable, civilized men, all champions of liberalism and democracy, who had consistently betrayed all the principles they so loudly proclaimed. They had gone back on their word, betrayed their friends, not once, but 10 times. They had committed a crime against the spirit. They had brought venality, treason, greed, stupidity, and hypocrisy to new heights. They had fatally undermined the foundations of Western civilization. In Prague, however, we were only halfway to Golgotha. 10 more countries awaited crucifixion.